da Assembleia da República, Augusto Santos Silva.
We're now going to open this session. Hello. Can you hear me on channel 2? So I welcome all of you to the Portuguese Parliament, the home of democracy. Special word of greetings to the chair of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, Mr. Tony Cox. Well, I'm also the Vice President of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And greetings to Professor Andrzej Malamud, our guest today, and that I will introduce later. Mr. Speaker of the Portuguese Parliament, Excellencies, globalization has reinforced the importance of the supranational and national scales. The pandemic has shown how important solidarity is. The war in Ukraine strengthened the importance of multilateralism and unity in action. In a multipolar world, dangerous and predictable that we live today, inter-regional relations become increasingly more important. Regions like countries are very unequal, but they are now more interdependent than before. In the context of the social and economic recovery that is still undergoing after the global pandemic, we are witnessing in Europe an increasing of populism as well as a regression movement regarding the European framework of laws, liberties and guarantees, and questioning the human rights principles. The war in Ukraine is an additional drawback. In Europe, as in other regions like Africa and Latin America, the reach and consequences of the current international context show a situation of interdependency and interconnection at global level. And this is particularly true as regards the efforts for the promotion and protection of human rights. Council of Europe is the oldest, the most ancient institution and the main organization of human rights in Europe. Therefore, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe plays a very important role in promoting, protecting, and accomplishing human rights, and is directly relevant to a number of values and fundamental principles like universality, indivisibility, equality, non-discrimination, participation and inclusion of vulnerable groups, and promoting the rule of law. Parliaments are one of the state institutions at the core of the respect for human rights. Parliamentary action, be it in passing laws or overseeing the governmental action, is fundamental to ensure that international human rights commitments are translated into national politics and laws, and to help guaranteeing the promotion and respect for human rights at internal level. The purpose of this conference today is to debate the contribution of parliamentarism and multilateral parliamentary organizations, namely the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, in promoting and protecting human rights. On the other hand, given the interdependence and global interdependence and interconnection, it's important to understand the role of parliamentary multilateral organizations, namely the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, in bringing closer Europe, Africa, and Latin America in matters of human rights and in the resolution of common challenges, so as to contribute to a world where all can prosper in peace, dignity, and equality. This could be the beginning of a path towards facilitating cooperation in a wide range of common interest areas, from the protection of human rights and sustainable development to the regulation of digital economy and the fight against organized crime. and to strengthen relationships, not just between parliaments and institutions, but also between the businessmen, students, universities, scientists, and creators. Eduardo Lorenzo, our great philosopher, the poet of thought, as he once was called, wrote a paper in 1949 when the Council of Europe was created. The paper was entitled Europe or the Dialogue that we are missing. Now, I wonder from our speakers if the dialogue that we are missing is between Europe, Africa, and Latin America. Well, and Asia as well. So, Mr. Speaker, I now give you the floor. Thank you. First, I would like to say that I'm very pleased, and it's a honor, the pleasure, to have today with us in the Parliament the President Tinnikoks, President of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. Council of Europe says a lot to the Portuguese democracy, and the best way to show it is to tell you a bit about the history of our accession to the Council of Europe. We had the revolution in the 25th of April 1974. Exactly 2 years later, we had the first elections were held for the new democratic parliament, the Assembly of the Republic, this assembly. And at the time, the first constitutional government of the Portuguese democracy was created, presided by Mr. Mário Soares. And one of the main decisions of this first constitutional government in the Portuguese democracy was to ask for Portugal's accession to the Council of Europe. Portugal acceded to the Council of Europe in September 1976. We acceded the European Convention of Human Rights in 1978. And since then, we feel full members of the Council of Europe. We are very proud to host this North-South Centre here in Lisbon, Council of Europe institution that works on the dialogue between the two sides of the Mediterranean. We are also very proud to be in the Council of Europe, the leaders of the European Union, to the matters of the suppression of death penalty. And we are also very proud that the Council of Europe, since 1997, is the first region in the world totally free of that terrible thing, which is the death penalty. So the Council of Europe is very important to us, and its essential mission to promote democracy, the rule of law, and human rights is our mission as well. My contribution to today's debate comprises three basic ideas. There is a fourth one, the importance of parliaments in human rights dialogues will be well presented and elaborated by Professor Andrés Malamud. Now, the three ideas that I would like to mention here are the following. The first one, as the Vice President or Vice Speaker Edith Strilo just said, is the dialogue about human rights is essential in today's world. And it is a dialogue that is not just limited to Europe or to the Council of Europe. Human rights, democracy, rule of law cannot be taken for granted, even within Europe, as unfortunately we have realized in these last years. So we have to keep on dialoguing or talking to each other on human rights. Dialoguing means not lecture to others, but to learn from each other. And this is absolutely essential when we talk about human rights. We should never think that some of us have done everything towards human rights accomplishment and can act as masters of the others. But we have to understand that we all have some thing done and some things to be done in terms of human rights, and we can always learn from the experience of the others. And this dialogue that should take place in the Council of Europe, of course, but also and mainly a dialogue between Europe and other regions of the world, with all other regions of the world. And among those, there are two regions that are of the utmost importance, at least in the Portuguese viewpoint. Africa, I mean, be it North of Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, and Latin America. So the Council of Europe should be seen by Europeans also as one of the tools we have available to elaborate, to extend this dialogue with Africa and Latin America, also concerning human rights and the rule of law, and to in-depth this dialogue, as I propose, learning from each other. We have to talk to the Africans and to the Latin Americans, assuming their own viewpoint, understanding how they feel the need for to develop their rights, civic rights, economic rights, social or cultural rights. Again, learning from each other. This is my second idea, that this dialogue should be not just within Europeans, but between Europe, Africa, and Latin America. And the Council of Europe is a good tool, a good platform for this dialogue to take place. The third and last idea I'd like to stress here is that the parliamentary dimension can and should contribute towards this dialogue. The Council of Europe has all interest in enhancing its relationships with the Parlatino, the Latin American Parliament. The Council of Europe also benefits from elaborating its dialogue with the African Union and its bodies. Again, there, Portugal can be of use, can help, can add value, because Portugal belongs to organizations that typically aim at structuring this dialogue between Europe and other regions of the world. Portugal is member of the Iberian American organizations. We have with us in the floor the representative of the Ibero-American Organization for Education in Portugal. And the Iberian-American organizations result from this dialogue between part of Europe, in this case Iberian Peninsula, Portugal, Spain, and Andorra, and the 21 Latin American countries. And this organization, this Iberian-American organization, has its own parliamentary forum, Iberian-American Forum. And Portugal is also a member of the Portuguese community of the Portuguese-speaking countries. That this triangular dialogue between Europe, Latin America, and Africa, and also CPLP, the Portuguese, the CPLP also has its parliamentary assembly allowing for this dialogue also to take place between parliamentarians. Hence, it is increasingly more important that we talk to each other on human rights, and this dialogue should be between us and between us Europeans, but also with Latin Americans and Africans and other parts of the world. And there are many organizations with which the Council of Europe should increase its outreach and enhancing dialogue on human rights at international level. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Now, a few words about our guest today. Tinny Cox is a Dutch politician. He was elected or re-elected 34th President of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe in January 2022. He is elected senator for the Netherlands Senate on the 10th of June 2003. He is currently the most senior senator in the Dutch Senate. Not much longer after being appointed president of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe on the 24th of February 2022, so tomorrow, 1 year, occurred the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. After this aggression, extraordinary session of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe was called, and this resulted in the suspension of Russia and later the expulsion of Russia from the Council of Europe. Now, it is my honor to give the floor to the President of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, Mr. Tini Cox. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, Edith, for your kind words. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the professor who is going to take care for the real wisdom behind this table. And thank you very much for you being here and inviting me for your conference on interparliamentary cooperation. And indeed, I think it makes sense that you invited me as the president of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, which is the oldest and broadest format of interparliamentary dialogue and cooperation in the whole of Europe. Founded in 1949, it was stipulated by the leaders of the then 10 countries who created the Council of Europe that only on the basis of justice and international cooperation we could perhaps protect the peace in Europe better than we did in the years and the decades before, in which we had two devastating world wars started on European soil. It is interesting that it will be this year 75 years that in the Hague, in the city where my parliament is based, my Dutch parliament is based, that under the leadership of Winston Churchill, a conference came together of politicians, scientists, writers, artists from both Europe and the United States to think how are there ways to prevent such a horrible thing as a world war to happen ever again. And the conclusion was that we have to refrain from unilateral acts of powerful countries, and we have to protect ourselves by a system of multilateralism. As I said in the meeting that I just had with you, Mr. Speaker, only if we surround ourselves with democracies, we protect ourselves probably best. Arms can be important, but democracy is a better means to defend your own democracies and democracies of others. That was in 1948, that the world did not find something better than functional multilateralism to contain the dangers of unilateralism. And then the Council of Europe was created, 10 founding members, amongst which my country, the Netherlands. And from the beginning, it was clear there has to be an intergovernmental cooperation of the governments, but there also should be a parliamentary dimension. It is great to listen to Winston Churchill, and there are some videos, smoking cigars. Everybody was smoking cigars except our poor queen. She was only coughing probably, but all these smoking cigars, politicians, scientists, writers, they came to the conclusion that they should give an important say to the parliaments. And again, those were not the biggest fans of parliaments, but they understood that in the countries that created the war, Parliament was set aside and governments had taken over. Germany is, of course, the worst example. So since then, there is intergovernmental and interparliamentary cooperation in Europe. It started with 10 countries. It lasted for quite a time like that. But then there were two waves of making the Council of Europe really the Council of Europe. First in the 70s, we discussed that earlier, Mr. Speaker, the southern countries who abandoned by themselves dictatorship and authoritarian rule came to the Council of Europe. That was the first important wave of increasing the relevance of the Council of Europe. So I'm still very grateful that your country then decided to join voluntarily the Council of Europe. Spain did, and Greece coming back to the Council of Europe. And then, of course, in the 90s, when the communism came to an end in Eastern Europe, and all European countries became a member state of the Council of Europe. So then we indeed became the United Europe, where Winston Churchill called for in 48, became a reality at the beginning of the 21st century, where only Belarus and the Vatican did not participate in the Council of Europe. The Vatican, for obvious reasons, they have some problems with democracy, you could say. But more important, Belarus, because it refused to refrain from skipping capital punishment from its criminal code. But then the whole of Europe was united. I joined the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly in 2003, and then for me this was a unique experience that you had all these states from Reykjavik to Vladivostok, all these citizens from Reykjavik to Vladivostok, from the North Pole to the Mediterranean, being united in one European construction with a parliamentary dimension as well, and all united under this beautiful European Convention on Human Rights, which has meant so much, I think, for your country, but for my country as well, and for all the states of Europe. In the Netherlands, you cannot propose a law that is not Strasbourg proof, that is not meeting the criteria of our European Convention on Human Rights. So for me, that was a unique experience. But from then on, there is not a causality, I think, but from then on, we saw also the unification of Europe becoming more problematic. And that developed in the decades after the beginning of the century. And now last year, on the 24th of February, we saw our biggest member state, Russia, walking away from its obligations to participate in a multilateral organization based on peace and arguments when it sent its army over the borders of Ukraine. From then, the very principles of our cooperation in the Council of Europe, rule of law, human rights, democracy, are fundamentally challenged by our biggest member state. I have to say by our former biggest member state, because as Edith referred to, one of the first things that I had to do after I was elected president was to call together both the parliamentary dimension and the intergovernmental dimension to decide that we had to suspend membership of Russia. The same day that the war started, we suspended membership. Our organization has never been so decisive and so promptly as then. And within 3 weeks, both the parliamentary and the intergovernmental part of the organization decided, yes, we have to exclude Russia from membership. We never ever did it, and I hope we never ever have to do it in the future, because the goal of the Council of Europe is bringing countries together, not excluding them. But if we would have kept Russia in our midst, then I think we would have discredited the whole organization, because it would be an open invitation to other countries who also have an army, who also have unilateral tendencies, to say, okay, if we cannot win it by arguments, if we cannot win it in a dialogue, we could give it a try to use our force, our army. So this was, I think, one of the saddest things that I had to do, to announce that our assembly was pleading for the exclusion of Russia, but at the same time I said it was one of the things, I say it again, one of the things of which our assembly can be proud, that we did the right thing on the right moment, and the signal was received in a very enthusiastic way in Kiev, and it was received in a very surprised way in Moscow. The Russian government never ever had thought that the Council of Europe would exclude them. They were at that moment 26 years member state of the Council of Europe. But that brings us now in the situation, Mr. Speaker, Madam Vice Speaker, that the Council of Europe has to rethink the very construction of our working together in this multilateralist framework, because we did not create the war, but we were not able to prevent it. The multilateralism in Europe was not strong enough to make it clear to President Putin, don't do it. Don't cross the borders of Ukraine, because then you cross the borders of the Council of Europe, then you cross the borders of international cooperation, then you exclude yourself from a civilized human society. We were not strong enough to do it, so I'm happy that also, I think, under the enthusiastic lead of our assembly and me myself, we were able to convince our political leaders that for the first time in 18 years, the heads of state and government have to come together in Reykjavik on the 16th and the 17th of May to discuss what to do to help Ukraine to defend itself against this unilateral aggression from Russia, but also how to strengthen us all together in order to avoid that this can never ever happen again. That is quite a challenge, and I'm proud that our heads of state and government did dare to take that decision, and I'm even more happy that I learned during my short stay here in Lisbon that your Prime Minister, Prime Minister Kosha, will be one of the prominent leaders of Europe who will participate in that that meeting in Reykjavik as well. As said, we there have to discuss how to help Ukraine, how to strengthen the system of multilateralism, how to protect democracy and to promote democracy, how to make fundamental human rights better protected, because Russia is now an aggressive state, but we have more states in the Council of Europe who have problems to commit themselves to the obligations that they have taken upon themselves voluntarily. And only if in Reykjavik our heads of state and government can again reaffirm that we want to be together in order to protect our own citizens, our own countries in the best possible way and to avoid unilateralism to become again the most driving force in politics, then we can have a historic meeting in Reykjavik. And I have taken care that also the parliamentary dimension will be represented, because I have called for a meeting of the standing committee. That means the leaders of the national delegation. So indeed, your agenda has to be cleared from half May, so that also the parliamentary assembly will be present in Reykjavik. We do not only have to react there on Russia's aggression and on the need of restoring and restrengthening and perhaps reinvent multilateralism in Europe, but also to work on the development of a new generation of fundamental rights. I'm proud that our assembly has proposed two items for the agenda in Reykjavik. That is how to make the right to a healthy and sound surrounding environment as a fundamental human right. We think that especially young people can be attracted by giving a body to the right to grow up in a healthy and sound environment as a fundamental human right. We are, I think, on track in this respect. And the other thing is how to balance artificial intelligence, which can bring us so much, but also so much good, but also so much harm, to balance it with human human rights. That will also be on the agenda of Reykjavik. Then I come to this is what we are doing in Europe. We have now over 200 conventions, the European Convention of Human Rights, the European Social Charter as the main convention, but also the European Convention to combat violence against women, against half of our citizens, you could say. These conventions are all now having effect to our citizens, our national states, and I hope that we will be able, and now I come to the issue that also was addressed by the speaker, that we do not keep them these things for ourselves. The good things that we have developed in Europe could be of value for others, especially in Africa and in Latin America. I am preparing a visit to Latin America during summer, I think, to visit Palatino and to meet with the parliamentarians there, not, as the speaker rightly said, not to teach them a lesson, but to learn a lesson from these attempts to have interparliamentary cooperation. And the same, yesterday I was convinced by U.S. Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs to also go to Africa to do the same there with the regional organizations and the African Union. We already have quite a lot of cooperation with, for example, formal cooperation with, for example, Palatino, but I'm not happy with the real effects of this cooperation that should be improved, and I want to use my presidency to do that better. I also want to use my presidency to convince, for example, Mexico, but perhaps also Brazil and other Latin American states to sign and ratify the Istanbul Convention for the Protection of Women Against Violence, because that is not a unique European value. That is a universal value, and by joining this open convention, Latin American countries could show that we are really working together. So that is one of my aims as well for the future. I think that we, as a Council of Europe, we have developed our tools to work together. We have the North-South Centre, which is an initiative of the Council of Europe. It could do better, I think, and that means that the Council of Europe should do better, and doing better is also giving more possibilities to the North-South Centre, not only nice words, but also real means. Furthermore, we have our Partnership for Democracy, in which we give parliaments of non-European states the possibility to participate in the work of our assembly. At this moment, we have the parliaments of Morocco, of Jordan, of Palestine, and of Kyrgyzstan participating in our work. They do not have voting rights, but for the rest, they can participate fully in our meetings. And furthermore, we have Canada, Mexico, and Israel as observer states, with the right to be represented in our assembly as well. I hope that we will be able to develop our cooperation with parliamentary institutions in both Africa and Latin America, and I hope to learn a lot during this conference in this respect. I thank you very much. Sorry for taking so long, but to explain the Council of Europe is not always easy, I have learned. It's difficult to explain it to my wife and my children, and not to talk about my grandchildren, but also to politicians. It needs sometimes to be explained before you understand what we are trying to do. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, dear President. Andrés Malamud é investigador.
Andrés Malamud, he's the main researcher at the Social Science Institute for the University of Lisbon, with a degree in political science from Buenos Aires, with a PhD in Florence. He's been a guest researcher at the Max Planck Institute at Heidelberg and at the University of Maryland College Park.
He's a visiting professor in universities in Argentina, Brazil, Spain, Italy, Mexico, and Portugal. He focuses on comparative politics, regional integration, external policy, European studies, and Latin American politics. You have the floor.
Muito bom dia. Vou falar em...
Good morning. I'll stand so that I can move around. It's an honor to be here at this event, and I thank you for the invitation. I'll speak about parliamentary institutions to see, and we'll see what they do about human rights. Parliaments were internal, domestic affairs. They were between the people and government. They were not meant to act between the people and between governments. This is a major change. And we'll see where parliaments are nowadays, what national parliaments do abroad, and what international parliaments do. And when we talk about parliament, we must think about two things. Democracy and citizenship. There are some fake parliaments in non-democratic regimes, but real parliaments represent the people's control of the government. Citizenship is something that has evolved a lot in Europe. The rest of the world is not as evolved as Europe when it comes to creating a supranational citizenship. Portuguese citizens are European citizens. They can move to Finland or to France and they will vote for the European Parliament. European Union is mentioned above the country's name in the passport. This is a victory over old-timey nationalism. The rest of the world is more Westphalian. There are no supranational citizenships. In the United States, you won't have the name of the region. NAFTA or USMCA, but not just the United States, Mexico. The same goes for Mexico. Mexico is a Latin American country. They have the same name as the United States of America, United States of Mexico, but there's nothing over the country's name in the passport. Let's move further down. We have Mercosur above the name of Argentina. And Brazil. For a time, on the cover, they had the flag of Mercosur and not Brazil. But then they went back to the Brazilian flag. But there's always Mercosur on their passports. This is symbolic. There is no citizenship for Mercosur. But I'd like to put it to you that there are three types of citizenship. European citizenship, African citizenship, that's traditional, and South American, which is something between common and traditional. In Africa, in order to travel, they will often need a visa to enter another African country. Not always, but often. In South America, you don't need a visa or a passport. In South America, you can just travel with your identity card. But this is not Schengen. You have to provide proof of identity. Europe is the example. So far, it's unattainable, but it's a major reference. In international parliamentary assemblies, you see there are several international parliamentary bodies. There's the interparliamentary body that convenes national parliaments, and there's PACE, which is the oldest body of international bodies, and then you see here in green Europe, orange Africa, and blue Latin America. This is the order in which regional parliaments were created. We can draw two conclusions. First, there's a sequence: Europe, Latin America, Africa. And Asia is not here. Asia is a continent all its own. If we divide the world into four major regions, Latin America and Africa are looking towards Europe and try to emulate it. Asia is on a different planet, and they represent 60% of the world's population. Let's not forget that. So we're in a minority. But what is a parliament? It's an assembly that, within a political system, performs four functions. A function of representation. 10 million people cannot have a say at the same time, so they choose representatives to represent them. This brings legitimacy, lends legitimacy to the political system. Second function is legislation. The third function is control and oversight. This is all part of the constitution. But the last one isn't. The last function, leadership training or formation. The parliament acts as a university. This is where the politicians learn to compromise, to not compromise, to draft laws. This is where they learn what's done abroad. More and more, diplomacy goes through parliament. You can't think of a democratic system without politicians that have learned something in the parliament. Even in dictatorships, the politicians learn in their parliaments or in parliaments abroad. And this is all very important. The European Parliament, not the Council of Europe, but the European Parliament is an exception. They have a wide range of powers, not as much as they'd like, but more so than others. They have legislative competences, and they have oversight tasks. They can even bring down the Commission. No other supranational or international parliament has this type of power. The European Parliament has been considered the third most powerful legislative chamber after the two American chambers. In Latin America, we have 20 countries. 18 speak Spanish, one speaks poor Portuguese, and there's Haiti that speaks French. Then we have the Caribbean, another 13 countries. So there's 35 countries. Canada, United States, 13 in the Caribbean, and the rest in Latin America. Latin America has no organization of its own. Europe doesn't either. The European Union has 27 countries, and Europe has more than 50. The Parlatino is the oldest institution, and it's very important. It doesn't belong to any regional organization. It's not a parliament for Eurolat. For a Latin American organization. It's autonomous. It has its own treaty. It was once headquartered in São Paulo, but then they couldn't pay the rent, so they moved to Panama. And this is true. And their headquarters now is better than before. These are the official languages: Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch. It's funny, because there's no Haiti, but there's an independent Dutch-speaking country, as well as other countries from belonging to the Kingdom of the Netherlands. They don't have oversight tasks. Their task was to protect the lives of activists during dictatorships. Raul Alfonsín, president of Argentina, he was often at Parlatino to get international visibility. For the dictatorship to kill Alfonsín, it would come at high cost. The Parlatino saved the lives of many people who came before it. In Central America, we have 8 countries, but they have one parliament with 6 members. Something that you will notice is that, first of all, they don't need interpreters. And all of them have the same type of representation. Parliaments in Latin America, they don't represent people, they represent the states. And in some cases, they're elected by the people, but they have equal representation. In the Andean community, you have 5 countries, they used to be They used to be six. Venezuela left, they joined Mercosur, and now they're suspended because they have this tiny little problem with democracy. But this is the original Mercosur parliament, and it has changed. Now, the Mercosur parliament is not working, but it has some proportionality. You can't have perfect proportionality because Brazil has 80% of Mercosur, but they cannot have 80% of the representation at the at Mercosur. So you'd have the minority. Nowadays you have the minority representing the majority. The parliament is a sounding box for domestic and regional issues. What's the influence of parliaments? How can they influence international politics? There's three ways this can happen. The first of all is the traditional way. In this parliament, when they vote for foreign policy as well. When they decide what to do with embassies, what to do in terms of alliances, when what they do in terms of war. They're voting for foreign policy. And there's an interparliamentary function. Then you can collect international, supranational parliaments. And these have different levels of innovation. The first task is not innovative, it's key. Parliaments control foreign policy. They've always done this. It varies from country to country. Parliamentary democracy is more and more relevant, and it has to do with human rights, democracy, and learning. In not so developed countries, poorer countries, with younger democracy, the politicians often don't know how to do certain things. And by mingling with their peers, that's where they come to learn. Finally, you can build supranational institutions. If you want to govern a region together, you need a regional parliament. Why does the European Union have one of these institutions and others don't? Because it's a very solid body. Mercosur doesn't have a common citizenship. They don't take joint decisions. The stronger the regional institution, the stronger its parliament. In closing, this is a picture of another room in this parliament. Human rights have a main enemy. The main enemy is war. That's where they're at their most vulnerable, during wars. What is the main enemy of war? It's peace? No. Peace is the opposite of war. The enemy of war is democracy. People from international relations, we know one thing. Democracies don't wage war amongst each other. The day that every country in the world has a democratic parliament, there will be no more wars and human rights will be assured. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigada, senhor professor.
Thank you very much, Professor Malamud. On behalf of the speaker, I thank you all for being here, Mr. Ambassadors, members of the diplomatic corps. I'd like to thank all the MPs, the representatives of several bodies and institutions, and I hereby close this conference, which I hope you enjoyed. And I hope this was useful for our MPs for future debates. Thank you very much all. Enjoy the rest of the day.